the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Good morning, everybody. Morning, lovely to see you all. My name's Johnny Baker. It's my huge privilege to speak to you this morning. In my day job, I work in a secondary school. I've had a two-week half term. I feel like I've got to confess that. So all those teachers who've been working this week, I'm really, really sorry, but I feel really good. Lovely to see you all here this morning. Over the past 10 weeks, we have been working our way, as Andrew said, through the Sermon on the Mount. That is in Matthew's account of the life of Jesus, chapters 5 to 7 of that book, we hear Jesus preaching the greatest sermon of all time. It's a collection of his greatest teaching, and it's my job to, this morning, just try and put it all together. Easy job in 25 minutes. But that's what we're going to try and do. We're going to just try and finish, look at the last few words that Jesus says, and then try and wrap the whole thing up together. Next week, as Andrew says, next week is Baptism Sunday, and then after that, we're heading into our Advent series. I apologize for this, but there are 45 days until Christmas. Over the past 10 weeks, we've worked our way through this. Now, if you haven't been with us, or if you don't know anything about the Sermon on the Mount, it's incredible because we hear from Jesus himself, and he tells us about what it means to follow him. The theologian and author John Stott said this about the Sermon. The Sermon on the Mount is the most complete description anywhere in the New Testament of the Christian countercultural. He helps us understand what it means to live the Christian life. So if you are here this morning and you are a follower of Jesus, it's great news. You're hearing instructions straight from Jesus' mouth about how to live in this world and how to flourish. If you're not a follower of Jesus here this morning, you're super welcome. We are so pleased that you're with us. But what's great is you can hear from our Savior and Lord about who he is and what he says. And you can decide for yourself whether Jesus is someone that you think, I can trust him. I can build my life on him. And this morning, he's going to bring Jesus this Sermon on the Mount to the close. And he does it in a way that we probably wouldn't expect. Now, this week has been quite a week for politicians all over the place. And I have no doubt that it has been a particularly long week for speechwriters. They must have had a lot of sleepless nights not knowing the outcomes of all sorts of things, writing multiple talks for their politicians. But despite those multiple sleepless nights, we've seen a lot of speeches this week. And I imagine that when they crafted these speeches, whether they win or lose or whatever, I imagine a lot of time is spent on the end. Have you thought about that? Often when the end of a sermon or talk happens, you want to leave people with an upbeat message or a main motif. You may remember Obama saying, yes, we can. You may remember Mr. Johnson saying, get Brexit done. And it's not just a political sphere as well, isn't it? If you were a coach of a football team and it's halftime and you're one down, what are the words you're going to say to send them on the pitch? If you're at a conference, what's the last thing you're going to say? If you're at church, what are you going to say when you finish? It's what do we think are the last few things that you could say to get the very best possible outcome, the best performance from a group of people. Personally, whenever I am speaking, I endeavor, if I can, to end on an upbeat, to finish in some sort of slightly possible way, possible upbeat way. Well, the Sermon on the Mount, which contains arguably all of Jesus' most important teachings, it doesn't end in the way that you'd expect. At the end of about 2,300 words, Jesus does not finish it with a pep talk. He does not give a recap of his greatest hits. He doesn't end it with a touching story or a rallying call. Jesus ends it with a series of warnings. Now, Steve introduced some of those warnings to us last week. And this week, it's my task just to look at the very, very last warning that there is before Jesus comes and finishes his sermon. And we're going to this morning just read Matthew 7, 24 to 29, page 919, my mistake, of a church Bible, if you could follow it. We're going to read two versions of this story. I'm going to read a different one to you first, then we're going to read from the NIV. So here comes version one. You may know this, you may not know it. Here is a man. He is looking for a place to build a house. He climbs to the top of a big grey rock. Ah, here's a good place. The man begins to build his house. It's hard work. He puffs and pants. He puffs and pants and grunts and groans all day until the work is done. Just in time, he says, it looks like rain. The rain pours down, the lightning flashes, the thunder booms, the water rushes around the house and splashes the rock. The rock stays firm. The man was wise to choose the rock. Here's another man. He wants a house. I want it now, I want it quick. This place will do, he says. He builds his house down on the sand. This won't take long, he says, as he whistles while he works. His house is done. He goes inside and shuts the door. A raindrop drips onto his nose. Oh, dear. The rain pours down. The lightning flashes. The thunder booms. The water rushes through the house and splashes at his knees. The sand is washed away. His house falls flat. The silly man was wrong to build on sand. Jesus says, I'm like the wise man's rock. If you trust me, I'll never let you down. Version 2. That's version 1. Here's version 2. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the storms rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall, because it had its foundations on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the storms rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. Those are Jesus' last words. Next verse in the Bible. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. Same story. That's the biblical version. The first version is different. They're the same story, but they're different, aren't they? Firstly, can I say this? I am not going to criticize Nick Butterworth and Mick Penn in this book, Stories Jesus Told. One reason is I won't be allowed back into my house if I do at the end, and because they're brilliant. What Nick Butterworth and Mick Penn do is they do something that I'm so grateful to them. They write for children, and they try to help young people understand who Jesus is and that he is someone that they can trust and build their life on. Their work is super important. I commend this book to any child and any parent to read to their children. It's brilliant. But there are differences, aren't there? Sometimes we can become so familiar with a story that actually we need to revisit it maybe when we're a little bit older to see and delve a little bit deeper into it. Because there's certain things in this story and many other stories that you may know before that we just need to check and have a look at. There's this phrase in the world, isn't there? Familiarity breeds contempt. It's well known. I think with Bible stories like this, it can be more like this, not contempt, but indifference. Sometimes we'll remember a story, but because we remember it, we might think, ah, yeah, I completed that one, done that. And we come to it with maybe a little bit of apathy and a dull ear. But please know this about the passage that we have just read, the story of the wise and foolish builder. It's not a cute Sunday school story. I'm sorry. It's a dark and a dire and a profound warning. And it's somber. It really is. Now, it's a pretty simple story on the face of it, but let's just make sure we've got it. I said I was on half term. I'm a maths teacher at heart. I've had a little bit more time this week. Okay. So that's a Venn diagram. I'm spoiling you. There's a flow chart later as well. So it's a simple story, but let's just make sure we've got it. It's really important. There are things the wise man does, things the foolish man does, and things that both do, don't they? What do they both do? They both build a house. Agreed? As well as that, they both experience a storm. Two. The third thing is they both hear Jesus' words. Those are similarities right through it. But there are differences, and two stark differences. The obvious one we know, don't we? One builds on rock, one builds on sand. But what is the crucial difference between these two? Well, the crucial difference between these two is that one puts into practice the words that they hear from Jesus, and one does not put into practice the words that they hear from Jesus. It's about two people, a wise person and a foolish one. The word wise in Greek is phronimos, which could mean smart, it could mean intelligent, could mean thoughtful or enlightened. The word foolish in Greek is moros, which could be translated stupid, says there, unintelligent, not thoughtful, unenlightened. What other word do you think that we get in English from the Greek word moros? Yeah, moron. This is a story about a wise builder and a moronic builder. It's important, though, it's not about good and bad. Do you notice that? This is about thoughtful and foolish. Dr. Dale Bruner says this: Jesus does not contrast good and bad in this parable, but thoughtful and foolish. There is an intelligence in morality, and there is a morality in genuine intelligence. The parable is about home building. Now, in Jesus' day, home was a common metaphor for your whole life. Homes are a bit different nowadays, but back then, homes were often multi-generational. You lived with two or three generations of your family. Think about that for a moment. And homes were not generally bought or sold unless you lived in somewhere like Jerusalem or Ephesus. Homes were built in the country. Most of the land was ancestral. So you lived on your ancestors' land, and eventually you moved in or you built an additional home. Businesses were run out of homes as well. So your home symbolized probably more than it does now. It's really about your whole life. But the key difference in this parable is, isn't it, is what people build on, whether they put into practice Jesus' words. See, the wise person, what does he do differently? Well, the wise person, they build their life on the foundations of Jesus' teaching. And the foolish one, who isn't quite as sharp, who isn't quite as switched on, they hear Jesus' teaching. Notice that. That's quite terrifying, isn't it? They hear Jesus' teaching. They may like it. They may not like it. We don't know that. There's not a lot in the parable, is there, in terms of words? But they don't do anything about it. We don't know why they don't do anything about it. Could be a myriad of reasons, couldn't it? They may not do anything about it because they're too busy. They may not do anything about it because they're tired. Maybe they prefer another way of living. Maybe they prefer another teacher. But they do not put these words into practice. And what's terrifying and doesn't quite come across, I think, in some of the children's literature is that initially you can't tell the difference between the two houses. You can't tell the difference between those who follow Jesus' teaching and the house on the rock and those who don't, the house on the sand. I think it's more like that. You see, the houses, there's no distinction, is there? It's not really like, oh no, where have we gone? It's not really like, oh, this guy's using wood and not putting it together very well, and that one is. The houses are the same. The difference comes, doesn't it, between the two house builders. It's only exposed when there's this catastrophic storm that happens to them. Now, what that storm symbolizes, I don't know. That is up for debate. Many think the storm symbolizes death itself, and it could well do, because it could also, but it also could symbolize like a challenge in your life. Something comes and it crushes you. So it could be something like losing a loved one. It could be like finding out you're unemployed. The storm could be a diagnosis. It could be the end of a relationship. It could be a death of a dream. It could be a divorce. You name it, what these things could be. Notice as well, it's not if the flood comes. Do you see that? It's when the flood comes. You'll know this, but the person who is wise and the person who's foolish, the person who follows Jesus' teaching and the one who doesn't, they both face hardship. A Christian is not someone who is immune from suffering and has a spiritual force filled over them so it can't touch them against storms and challenges. Jesus is pretty honest here, isn't he? That whoever you are, wherever you go in this world, you will face a tough time. Both experience, verse 25, 27, you can see it exactly the same storm. Those who put Jesus' words into practice, they go through a flood. Those who don't put Jesus' words into practice, they go through a flood too. Jesus is honest that life is tough, but his way does not lead you out of hardship, it leads you through hardship. And that's what Jesus did. When the flood comes, and the flood will come for all of us in this room at some point, it really will. Love, what a message I'm bringing today. But it will. We know that, don't we? It's just being real. The flood will come, and what it will do, it will reveal for us what our lives are actually built on. And that will either be one of the best moments in our life or one of the worst moments in our life. You see, if our lives are built on greed, if our life's built on materialism, if it's built on competition, if it's about your appearance, youth, beauty, sex, whatever, if your life is built on popularity, like the number of followers you have, if it is built on pleasure, if it is built on money, if it is built on travel, you name it, rather than on putting Jesus' teaching into practice, then one day the Bible tells us that after those storms, what will happen is it will fall with a great crash. That's what will happen. If it's built on rock, it does not fall. If it's built on sand, it will fall with a great crash. It's hard, isn't it? Jesus is two things beautifully, isn't he, all the time? He's loving and he's truthful. Jesus is saying to us, life is hard. And some of this teaching is really, really difficult. But we've got to listen to him and put his words into practice because they are the very best thing that any human being could do. Now, if you were with us at the start of the series, Paul kicked off this series with a quote from Sheridan Voysey. We were just sort of saying how famous this Sermon on the Mount is that I could pick, if you went on Google and Googled Sermon on the Mount, presidents talk about it, all sorts of people talk about it. But really, it's about the last sentence there in that quote. See, from but one thing at the bottom, but one thing is required. If they're to manifest a resilient life, according to Jesus, they must be lived. The Sermon on the Mount is not simply Jesus passing on information and sitting down. That's not what this is about. That's not what anything we do on a Sunday morning is about at Belmont. Information alone does not equal transformation. Knowing something is not the same as doing something, and knowing something is not the same as doing something or even wanting to do something. Jesus' vision is not just a set of ideas that you subscribe to. It's a way of life. It's mind and it's body. Jesus didn't want to just come and inform us. He wanted to come and transform us. And it takes more than literal just passing on of information. I mean, it's so wonderful that we're listening to God's word, that we do it in home groups in the week as well. But that's not enough. You see, Jesus has told us that at the start of the sermon, if you listened, because he bookends the sermon with a call to practice. Do you see that? In week 3, when Steve was speaking to us, there was this verse, 5:19. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Jesus then ends in this part by a call to practice. And I think that Jesus assumes that some of this stuff is going to take a lifetime of practice. Don't know about you, I do not like the word practice. It brings back horrific childhood memories of scales, endless scales, trying to work out and practice something, get it right. I like golf. If I want to change my golf swing, I cannot just rock up and change my golf swing. I have to hit hundreds and hundreds of golf balls. If I want to make a better cricket stroke, I can't just suddenly decide to change it. I have to do it again and again and again until it feels natural. The change doesn't happen instantaneously, but it does to begin to after practice, I think. Think about it from this series. In week 8, Paul helped us with a really large section, end of 6 into chapter 7. And one of the verses that Paul helped us look at was, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life. Now I'm guessing, now if you've done this, amazing, can I speak to you afterwards? I'm guessing at the end of that sermon, you didn't go, oh, don't worry. Oh, okay, I won't worry. Yeah, done that. And you haven't worried since. Really? But if you have, please come and see me. Equally, week 5, we're looking at lust. Don't look at a woman lustfully. Already committed. Oh, okay. Now you've told me not to go on that way. I'll just stop it. And I haven't done it since. Doesn't work like that, does it? I don't think. Sometimes it does. But it's about putting it into practice. But you know what? After week 8, when Paul was going through that passage, if when we were called to not worry about our lives and we went, that's really difficult, but you know what, I'm going to place my worry, I'm just going to pray a bit more. I'm going to take that big worry and I'm going to put it in front of the creator and sustainer of the universe and I'm going to ask him just to help me with it. You're putting it into practice. You're starting to do these things. If after week 5 you went, that's really hard, but you know what, I'm going to delete that app because that app, I know I press this button and that takes me to there and I'm really in a place I don't want to be and I keep going. Or if you blocked it, or a website, or if you put on some accountability software, you're beginning to put into practice Jesus' teaching. And every single time that you put into practice Jesus' teaching, you are building on rock. Come on, you two. And every time we ignore his words, we're building on sand. Now, it's my task to just try and just summarize what we've done and try and bring this, put it all together as the path it says. But what we've been doing each week is we've been creating opportunities to put into practice Jesus' teaching. But also there has been, of course, the opportunity to not put into practice in Jesus' teaching. So that's where we've been for the last 10 weeks. If you haven't been with us, some of this won't make much sense, but you can catch up online. I hope most of it does to you. But week 1, we looked at them earlier when we were doing remembrance, the Beatitudes. Paul helped us with that. We were looking at blessed are the poor in spirit. If you've realized that all we can bring to God is our need for him, if you've been someone who's been going, that, God, I need you. I cannot let go a day, an hour, a minute without you. Then you've been building on rock. But if you've been somebody who has been, yeah, God, you're great, but you know what? I'll come back to you when I need you. Things are all right at the moment, and I'm not particularly dependent on you, but I am when it gets tough. Then you've been building your life on sand. Week 2, we looked at this, where Jesus says that we are, if we follow Jesus, the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Now, if you've been out there sharing Jesus in word and deed, if you have been distinct from this world, if you have been showing that there's a different way to live, then you've been building on rock. But if you've been out there in this world blending in, if you've been gossiping in the workplace, if you've just been doing all the things that all your non-Christian mates do to an excess, then you're building on sand. Week 3, we realized that Jesus is the how of the Sermon on the Mount. You've been building on rock. But if you've been trying to follow Jesus' teaching without him, doing it all by yourself, then you are building on sand. Week 4, we looked at anger. If you've been looking to put things right with people, well done you. You've taken that disharmony and you've been trying to put it together, trying to build bridges with people, you're building on rock. But if you have been treating other people with contempt, if you've forgotten that all people are made in the image of God, and you're still angry with them and building on that, you're building actually on sand. Week 5. We had this phrase, didn't we? A human being only truly flourishes when Jesus is on the throne. If you've been putting Jesus on the throne, then you've been building on rock. If you've been remembering that we're called to love people and not lust after them, then that's what you've been doing. But if you have been treating people as they don't have ultimate value, and you've been lusting after them, then you've been building on sand. Week 6, if you have been, help Steve, I might need you. That was the way of it, wasn't it? What was that about? Our being precedes our doing. So if we have been loving our neighbors, including our enemies, we've been building on rock. But if we haven't been, then we've been building on sand. And can you remember in week 7 what actually gets results in the kingdom of God? It's not Bananarama. Actually, what gets results is this. It's what you do and the way you do it and why you do it. So if you've been living your life for an audience of one, the praise of God the Father only, then you're building on rock. But if you've been doing your acts publicly so everybody else can see you and look at my giving and look at my... No. You're building on sand as well. You might have remembered... this quote from Scott McKnight, my mind is tied too much to the here and now and not enough to God's future kingdom. That kingdom in the future will shape how we live. There's a yearning for the kingdom at work in Jesus' prayer. as I sat and listened to that and read and reflected on that, an illustration I have overused came to mind, but I think we need to just place it here again. Francis Chan, you may remember this, you may not. He once took to the stage in his church with a massive piece of rope, and on the very end of it, there was a little red bit. And the rope signified the existence of a human being, and the red part about our time on earth. And Francis Chan was going, why do people spend so much time obsessing about the little red bit and not live for the whole of eternity? If you've been living for the red bit all the time, then you're building on sand. But if you have been living with this whole rope in mind for the white bit that goes on forever and ever and ever, you've been building for the future. And you're a wise person, says Jesus. Week 8, we're nearly there. There was this wonderful quote that Paul gave us from Tim Keller. It made a lot of us think, I think, which was, the true God of your heart is what your thoughts effortlessly go to when there is nothing else demanding your attention. The question was, where's our treasure? Where is it? All of us worship. Where is our treasure? And you see, if you're foolish, then your attention gets driven towards money and other things and taken away from the Lord Jesus. But if you've spent time since that week focusing on Jesus, because when you see Jesus dying to make you his treasure, that will make him yours, then you've been building on rock and doing the right thing. And last week, we had this choice, didn't we? The sermon ends in a difficult way. Are you going to go through the wide gate or are you going to go through the narrow gate? If you've been walking through the narrow Jesus gate and walking the Jesus way, perfect timing, well done, then you've been building on rock. But if you've been going down that wide route and ignoring Jesus, then you've been building on sand. Thank you so much, boys, you can go. Much appreciated. Jesus' great sermon ends with a series of either ors. If you look at chapter 7 at the end of it, it's a lot of either ors. Narrow gate, wide gate. If you look in your Bible, true prophet. True disciple, false disciple. Wise builder, foolish builder. And it ends there. The last words that Jesus says are, it will fall with a great crash. Isn't that stark that these two things, the last thing Jesus says, sorry, Dan, is that it will just fall with a great crash. We have choices to make. And as Jesus says, a great crash, I don't think there's a pulpit on the hill he spoke on, but Jesus gets down, and what happens next? We read it. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. As we close this series, the band are going to come up now. But I promise you a flow chart. Here it is. First question is this. What do you make of Jesus? Like the original audience, are you astonished? Has your mind been blown as we've looked at this countercultural and awesome teaching that would turn the world on its head and make it such a better place? And the answer for some people will be, no, I'm not astonished by Jesus. If that's you, it's my common joke, but I'd go and read it again. But there may be people here who are not astonished by it, and you may not have understood it. If you've not understood anything that myself, Paul, or Steve have said, please come and chat to us, come chat to Andrew, anyone you've seen. We would love to have a conversation with you about Jesus' teaching. It may be, though, that you're not astonished because actually you don't think that Jesus and his kingdom are good news. Again, if that's you, we'd love to chat because we think that Jesus is the greatest news that any human being could ever hear, and the decision to follow him is the greatest thing that any human being could ever do. We would love to stay in the conversation with you. There's people getting baptized next week who would love to tell you next week why Jesus is so brilliant and transform their lives as well. But if you are astonished, and we'll get through that there, and I'm hoping that actually is the majority of us, whether we follow Jesus or not, because even if you don't follow Jesus, it's pretty mind-boggling teaching that we've been looking at. It's just a very simple question, isn't it? Will you put it into practice? And if you say no, Jesus says that's foolish. If you say yes and you do it, well done. Well done. If you put into practice Jesus' teaching, you are wise and you are self-safeguarding yourself and others from future calamity when the inevitable storms of life hit all of us. Now, I say others deliberately because following Jesus is an individual decision, but you don't need me to tell you that there's collateral damage as well, isn't there, when we don't put Jesus' teaching into practice. Tragically, I've seen marriages, families, friends destroyed when people have ignored Jesus' teaching. Parents, quick question for you as we close. Are you more interested in your children putting the national curriculum into practice than you are in them putting Jesus' words into practice? If you are, that's foolish. It's important. It's not bad to want your children to do well. Of course it's not. But it's more important for them to put Jesus' words into practice. And everyone, if you are more bothered this morning by learning that there are only 45 days till Christmas than you are about putting Jesus' words into practice, then Jesus says that that is foolish. Our priority should be putting Jesus' words into practice for ourselves, but also for this world. What will happen if we put Jesus' words into practice? I'd love us to try. What would it be amazing, wouldn't it? This world would transform. Now, I need to stop. Now, I've resisted my urge. I would love to finish a 10-week series with a powerful quote, an uplifting story. But Jesus didn't do that, did he? And however uncomfortable I feel not doing that right now, if Jesus thought his ending was all right, I'm not going to argue with him. So.